Hi, and welcome to the Greenify Your Digital Life panel. Before we get to the panelists' introductions, I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I'm Jennifer Schlegel, Director of Conferences and Online Events for TechSoup.org and our NetSquared project. TechSoup is a nonprofit that provides discounted and donated technology products, tools, resources, and information to other nonprofits and NGOs around the globe. We also offer programs like the Clean and Green IT and Refurbished Computer Initiative and NetSquared, which helps social benefit organizations use the social web, all of which you can learn more about by picking up some info. We'll have some out by the doors on your way out, or you can talk to me after the panel. So I should start by telling you now that I'm far from being an expert on this topic of green technology. I'm here to explore, help facilitate, and most of all learn from our panelists and from many of you, who I know are quite knowledgeable and experienced in this area. So I encourage you to please contribute and participate in this session, because that's exactly what we've tried to put together for you today, a conversation rather than a one-way communication. And we hope we're not breaking any sacred South by Southwest rules or inviting total anarchy and chaos here, but our generous panelists have agreed to take questions throughout the session rather than save them for the last few minutes. How many of you would prefer to do that, to ask questions throughout? Or how many would rather wait until the end? And most people don't care either way, so. Just come up to the mic whenever you're ready with questions during the panel. So now let's meet our panelists. I'll ask each of them to introduce themselves to you, tell you about their work and their own unique perspectives and passions around green tech. Who wants to start?
Sure, I'll start. Hi, my name is Katie Fehrenbacher. I'm the editor of earthtotech.com. Could you bring up earthtotech, if you could? It's a little less well-known than Dwell and Wired. But we are a clean tech news site that was started about 9 months ago. It's part of the GigaOM.com network, which we cover startups in Silicon Valley, but mainly broadband-based startups. And Earth to Tech covers emerging clean technologies and the entrepreneurs that create those innovations, as well as the investors that fund them. So we are somewhat a business-based site, so we follow the industry. We also, consumers can relate to it as well, but we do track the industry specifically. A lot of the companies we write about are Silicon Valley-based. They have venture capital funding. And we cover various types of companies, from solar to biofuels to companies building energy-efficient IT and software, energy storage technologies. Some of the bigger stories we covered this year were perhaps Tesla, which is an electric car company in Silicon Valley that they made their first production car this year. When Al Gore joined Kleiner Perkins, the venture capital firm, last year, that was kind of a big deal for us. And NanoSolar is a thin film solar company in Silicon Valley, and they started producing their low-cost thin film solar in December, so that was big news for us. So we cover stories like that. And I've been writing about technology in Silicon Valley for the past 6 years. And I used to write for Red Herring and Gadget. And I was a reporter in the Silicon Valley Bureau of a Japanese newspaper. So that's my experience in the area.
I'm Sarah Rich, and I'm currently an editor at Dwell Magazine, which, for those of you that don't know, is a magazine about architecture and design. And I'm sort of the green editor there, so I cover, I edit our section called Off the Grid, which covers green building, another called 101, which is kind of the how-to DIY, how to take it into your own hands and apply some of the principles of design. And as well as a new section we have called Process, which sort of goes behind the scenes and looks at the backstory manufacturing process to create a particular product. So that's sort of actually kind of in line with what we're talking about today, in the sense that a lot of companies are starting to get more interested in being transparent with their customers about how they create their products. So this is kind of starting to look into that a little bit more. Prior to Dwell, I was the managing editor of World Changing, which some of you may know of. It's a blog online magazine about sustainability in the 21st century, kind of from a futurist point of view, as well as the managing editor of Inhabitat, which was actually founded by Katie's sister, Jill Fehrenbacher, and is all about sustainable design and architecture. So I've sort of come to technology in the sustainability realm more from the sustainability background than from a tech background. I used to be involved pretty deeply in food and still am a little bit, and that's sort of how I entered into sustainability. But through coming into design and architecture, it's made a lot of sense to start looking at technology, since that's kind of one of the primary solution modes for a lot of architecture and design challenges. So that's where I am now.
Hi, I'm Alexis Madrigal, and I write energy and science at Wired.com, which means I cover everything from like those little monkeys that they seem to discover all the time to like big solar thermal plants and everything in between. I got into writing about green technology because it was clear that there was a whole like suite of problems around energy and natural resources, and as venture capitalists, particularly the green kind, say, where there's problems, there's also opportunities that are really valuable. Before that, I wrote a lot about consumers of video games and various other things. I think a lot I became particularly interested in kind of non-early adopters, or just kind of regular mainstream go to Walmart types of consumers. And maybe that stems from kind of my deep background as a nerdy kid who was forced to move from Los Angeles to rural Washington State, and falling in love with like BBSs and then eventually the internet, but being out in this kind of wilderness that was very much not San Francisco, where I live now. And I'm really just, I just want to say thanks for coming out early, and I'm also really honored to be on this panel because the women up here are totally brilliant and have a lot more interesting stuff to say than I do. In fact, one of them is sort of my boss. I write a little bit for Katie at Earth to Tech. I also want to tell you that I'm on I'm Twitter. You can Twitter me at Alexis Madrigal, and I'm also in the Meebo chat room. I'm going to try and check in from time to time if you guys would rather get in touch with us that way. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. So before we go on, there's just a few things we'd like you to know and a few things we'd like you to think about before we move on. And as Alexis said, he'll be monitoring the Meebo chat room just in the name of transparency, and also maybe in an attempt to learn a little lesson from the Mark Zuckerberg interview. And this also echoes a big theme that I'm borrowing from the eTech conference, which is revealing invisible data and networks. And I'll talk a bit more about that later on. Now, some of you may have the expectation of going home with a list of, you know, 10 tips, such as turn off and unplug your machines when not in use, invest in rechargeable batteries, et cetera. But we all agreed that this was basic information, which most of you are fairly well versed in, and for anyone who isn't, it can be easily Googled. Since we think of the South by Southwest crowd as helping to lead the way with new technology solutions, we thought we'd present you with some ways to think about how to reprogram your digital life. At the end of the session, we'll ask for your participation in adding to this list. So here's a quick look at it now. Please keep this in mind throughout the panel and be ready to comment and contribute during the last few minutes of the session. And finally, just to help us gauge a little bit where you're at, how many of you have calculated your carbon footprints online? Okay, a fair amount of you. How many of you would like a basic demo? I guess I'm assuming those of you who haven't. And then I guess the rest of you might prefer to go right into some expanded kind of footprint applications. Okay. I know this can be a little bit awkward and it's early in the morning, but my guess is that there are some really interesting people here in the room. So if you could just take 2 minutes to turn around or turn to the person next to you just say hi and tell them why you chose to come to this panel today.
Hey, they're actually doing it. Look at that. They did it.
Yeah, they're actually doing it.
I know. It's
going to be hard to stop. That's cool. What?
You're very eager.
So maybe actually that guy. So are you doing a demo or no? I'd say don't.
You don't think?
I think it may take too much time.
I guess I'll wait till the very end.
If we do it, maybe at the end.
There was a guy in the platform on the aisle who was like, I want a demo, so maybe he could be our guinea pig if he wants to do it. Yeah.
Sure. Also, when I talk about the like green, the network effect on green, like we could do it there because like three of the network things, they all include carbon footprints.
That's a good idea.
Calculators in them.
Yeah. Cool. All
right.
Should we keep moving?
Yeah.
Okay. Hate to cut everybody off. Hopefully, you can continue these conversations a bit later. I'm just going to take a couple quick minutes right now before we get into the new ideas, solutions, tools, and gadgets. I'm just going to throw a little bit of the bad news out at you. We all know there's a problem, and a pretty big one at that, but I'll try to present just a few data points to help make it a little less abstract. Here's the most cited statistic regarding the need for green IT. According to Gartner Research, carbon dioxide emissions related to the operation servers and PCs account for 0.75 of the annual global total. Add to that the emissions generated by telecom networks, and IT's contribution to the atmosphere's greenhouse gas load is probably in excess of 2%. This is comparable to the level of greenhouse gases being produced by all the world's airplanes. And this comes from the January 2008 National Geographic article on e-waste, which I highly recommend. I'm also pulling the photos from there as well, but I highly recommend you check it out if you haven't seen it yet. And this is kind of the basic statistical core of the piece, is that according to the US EPA, 30 to 40 million PCs will be ready for end-of-life management in each of the next few years. The EPA also estimated that in 2006, between 1.5 and 1.9 million tons of computers, TVs, VCRs, monitors, cell phones, and other equipment were discarded. If all sources of e-waste are counted, the UN Environment Program estimates that it could total 50 million tons a year worldwide. The trend of shipping waste to the developing world, according to this expose in National Geographic, is likely to continue. In the US, it's estimated that 70% of computers and monitors and over 80% of TVs eventually end up in landfills, despite a growing number of state laws prohibiting the dumping of e-waste. In addition, about 180 million TVs, PCs, and other components sit in storage, which has its own environmental downfall.
I just wanted to hop in for a second. I don't know if you've seen Ed Bertinsky's work on e-waste, but it's like a really great visual representation of all these things. He like went to China, and it's just there's an amazing documentary, the name of which...
Manufactured Landscapes.
There you go.
And just one last point here. Here are a couple of highlights from a recent E-Week magazine article. The federal government's Energy Star program estimates that you can save anywhere from $25 to $75 per PC per year by using the power management features. About 31.2 million of the 104 million corporate PCs in the US are left on all night. And the carbon emissions saved by turning off every one of those computers would be the same as taking every car in Maryland off the road. And one more data point that's not up there. According to a recent eWeek survey, 45% of respondents, that's corporate respondents, indicated that their company has a program in place to reduce their carbon footprint, and 51% are willing to trade some performance for reduced emissions. So now we're moving on to the good news. And now we'll move on to our tours. The panelists will kind of give you a whirlwind tour of some of their favorite sites, online tools, gadgets, and products.
No, that's all right. I can reach over. And I think the other thing, too, in addition to tools and gadgets and websites, I mean, there's also just some ideas and ways of thinking about things and to borrow the world-changing line, tools, models, and ideas, right? So, you hear a lot about unplugging, right? I mean, everyone's always like, unplugging to save energy. And we sort of figured with this crowd, kind of unlikely. And so we wanted to say, hey, what kind of solutions can we come up with by plugging in more deeply? And so when we were thinking about this, these are some of the things that I was able to pull out, right? Taking and automating, using the technologies we have like in the online world and applying it to the offline world. And so that means automating sharing, say, right? I mean, it's much more efficient to have a computer do matching for people who are trying to find rides to go to the same place than it is for people to like post a million messages and try and find someone going to like, you know, 4th and Sanders or whatever. Energy efficiency is the same thing, and we're going to get into these things a little more deeply. It's great to tell everyone to, you know, turn off the lights, but it's even better if a computer just does it automatically. And a big part of all these things are going to be networking the actual stuff that you have, and that means, you know, networking the lights and networking the heating in your house. And in particular, I think we can do a huge amount of work with homes and cars. And the last piece of it is essentially taking some of the embodied energy. I think everyone's probably kind of familiar with that concept, but you know, the amount of energy it took to make something, and thinking about those devices as not just pieces of metal or plastic that consume energy, but things that can also make energy. And I think we all touch somewhat on each of those topics. So the first idea I wanted to bring up was kind of this mixed reality. I'm up here, I'm on Meebo, you know, we're kind of co-located, we're also in this virtual world, and we want to do the same types of things to interact more efficiently. Don't get caught up on the Segway up here. I know the Segways are lame, but there's also... what you're looking at here is a company called Intrago's product. And what it is, it's a personal mobility platform where they have electric bicycles and they have a wide variety of other types of ways to move yourself around a city that all have this digital platform driving. It's basically Zipcar plus like the Paris bike rental system. So as you see, Zipcar's up there. I think everyone's familiar with that. It's basically how do you move people without moving the metal that they're encased in their cars, right? Another way that you could do this is through, I guess what I'm calling here, i-hitchhiking, right? And I think Katie has a little bit to talk about this. Basically, how do you use the internet to find a ride around town?
Well, one of the things that we write about at Earth Tech a little bit is Facebook applications that people are creating to fight climate change and have a greener lifestyle. So one of those is the carpool application. I don't know if you wanted to pull that up, if you can find that. And it's basically a group put it together, and you know, through the Facebook network effect, you can find a nearby, closer, and compatible community. If we can't find it, it's fine. I mean, you can just search in the application section of Facebook and download it. And they've been finding some pretty good success, better than, say, if you go on Craigslist, or better if you, there's some other carpool website sharing services, but the Facebook application is actually finding some surprising success. So.
And I guess the other thing I wanted to add on this, too, I mean, this is a solution that could apply all over the world. I mean, I talked with a guy named Darius Roberts, who's a Berkeley graduate student trying to start a car sharing service in China. And talking about using SMS and using the internet to help people in China do the same thing. And apparently right now there's already some sites that are getting some traction. I mean, Chinese numbers for internet companies are huge, but you know, a few hundred thousand users for car sharing services is pretty amazing.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about smart charging in relation to that. As our cars get more and more connected, there's a bunch of companies who are just creating basically ways for you to have internet access in your car or to have your car be updated through a broadband connection. But specifically smart charging, it's a way to connect electric vehicles to the utility in your city using wireless internet protocols. So utilities can remotely control the speed that the electric vehicle charges. And the utility wants to do that because it's better on their pipes, and they can also give the electric car user a kickback on their electricity rates. And one of the companies we've written about a lot is a Seattle-based company called V2Green, and they build the hardware and the software, the back end basically, to start this connection, a two-way connection between your electric vehicle and the utility. And that company actually uses the cellular EVDO networks to make that connection, and it's pretty interesting. They're doing a field trial in Austin now with Austin Energy. There's only two vehicles involved, but they're trying to figure out how valuable this is for the utility. So,
so here we're talking a little bit about energy efficiency in the home, right? And Jimmy Carter gave this famous speech where he urged like conservation and wore a sweater, to kind of let everyone know that that's, just turn down the thermostat, right? But really, like, not everyone does that, and people want to be comfortable in their homes and all these, I live in a place where we don't have central heating and it kind of sucks. So there are companies now that have developed sort of applications that allow you to sort of selectively heat people or individual rooms without necessarily heating your entire house. And MyTemp and Logotech are both companies that do this. They actually have this little kind of inflatable balloon that goes into your HVAC system, and then you have a little control panel, and you say, well, I want it to be 69 degrees in my bedroom, but I don't really care how warm the living room is at nighttime, right? And so you're getting that type of control. You combine that with something like smart metering, which is basically allows you to visualize and know how much money you're spending on power at any one time, with the idea that if you know, you're not going to spend as much money. So you combine those two things, and you're able to see what reducing what kind of different energy profiles for your home, what kind of energy savings in both in dollars and sort of kilowatts per what you want. And the sort of the final step in that for me is there's a company named Consumer Powerline, and they're essentially like a load management system, and they help stores like, say, IKEA automatically switch off like every other light, right? In an IKEA store, you don't notice as a shopper, you're still like, whatever, buying plastic crap, but you are still, you're saving energy, right? I mean, that's why they're doing it, because it's saving them money, particularly at peak load times when the energy is actually a little bit more expensive. And so I don't know when they're going to be coming out with a home thing necessarily, but you can see once you've got that information and once you're able to like, have that data, you can all of a sudden it opens up this whole entire world to being able to control yourself and tweak it or have a computer do it for you. And here we're talking about gadgets, as we mentioned earlier. And Habitat put on a Greener Gadgets conference that had like a bunch of really amazing stuff. One of which I wanted to mention was this Remix project. Basically, this company wants to position themselves, and it's kind of a concept company, but they want to position themselves as a service provider that sits in between you, the consumer, and all these consumer electronics companies. And you would subscribe to their service that would have all of these modular parts. So like all gadgets are made out of the same like 10 pieces, or at least the plastic parts of them, or whatever, however it goes, it's a concept, right? And you would be able to like swap gadgets in and out of this thing. So like none of the actual material is being wasted, and you continue to get new gadgets as you're subscribed to the service. I mean, this is a little bit, this is a ways off, right? But in the meantime, you can be thinking about how you can use the most recycled materials. And in fact, Nokia is coming out with a phone that's made from all recycled materials. So we're a little bit ways off from actually developing a service. And I think Sarah's going to talk about that a little more, about how you develop like a service system instead of just like getting a product, like a hunk of material. The other things on here, sort of right-sizing devices, right? I mean, you see, like, Asus has this little PC. There's the OLPC laptop. People are figuring they don't need these, like, huge boxes to do most of what they do. And in using those smaller devices, they actually are saving energy because a lot of those devices can use more energy-efficient chips. And I think on the science horizon, there's these low-voltage chips that essentially turn down the water pressure for the energy that you're using. Actually, mostly the military is funding the type of research because they're really concerned about energy efficiency, too.
I'll probably talk a little bit more about some of those things. Greener Gadgets was a conference that was in January in New York, and I organized a section of that, and that was about alternative energy powering mobile devices. So we talked about alternative energy, also more energy-efficient gadgets. And some of those companies we invited, they were startups and backed by some venture capitalists. But one of them was called M2E Power. They are an Idaho-based company, and they make a micro generator and energy storage device that actually fits into a traditional battery. And that captures, that device captures your movement. It's kinetically powered energy. So it can basically have a traditional gadget with this add-on device can capture and store energy from your movement and make that device that much more efficient. And the company, it's somewhat similar to, maybe some of you remember the flashlight battery, the flashlights that you shake and they would produce an energy. That's a pretty inefficient kind of older technology that companies have been working on for a while. So this is the next generation of kinetic energy. This company, M2E Power, is actually testing the technology with the military right now in 2008, and they'll be bringing it to consumer electronics probably sometime next year. Some of the other gadgets we talked about at Greener Gadgets was the Hi Mini wind-powered device. We don't have a slide up, but basically it's about this big, and you put it on the front of your bike. You can only use it when you're moving, so the wind has to actually go through it, and it powers, it stores the captured energy, and you can power a consumer electronic with that. And then there's other solar-powered devices. I actually brought
one. Let's go. We should probably maybe go to the next slide.
Oh, yeah. Do you have
So, you know, and sort of answering the question that's at the top, right, how do you get the same performance without cost? A lot of those other things were use less power. And this is basically, you know, swap out the material so that the material is actually doing some of the work, kind of from the theme of earlier of, you know, generating some of your own power. Shake, rattle, and hum is basically there's a class of materials, ferroelectric materials that you see there, ferro solutions. That thing actually generates energy from the hum on boats for the Navy. So they have all these sensors all over the boat, and they're all powered by the actual just vibration on the boat. And it's called ferroelectric materials. And there's also, I want to talk about Novomer at the bottom. I mean, there are some upstream materials innovation that's going on right now, too. This is a company that is making better plastic. They essentially take waste CO2 and combine it into plastic. And that's it's kind of a different process from the way that plastic has generally been made out of, you know, oil, right? And then the last one, that's flexible solar photovoltaic cells. And the idea is that you would build these into the actual gadgets. Like a great example is like the Aptera. Are you guys familiar with the Aptera? It's this sort of big space-age-looking car, little space-age-looking car. They actually put solar cells on the roof. And those solar cells power the air conditioning. So when you're driving around and it's really hot outside and the sun's beating down your car, that's actually what's driving your air conditioning. And actually, I think Katie has an example of some solar PV.
Okay, well, there's a company called Voltaic who makes backpacks that have solar embedded. This is kind of, I brought one with me, but it's got these solar panels on the back. It charges a battery. And then this is their first generation product, so it only does about 4 watts at a time. So you can only charge your cell phone. The next generation does a lot more, and you can charge your laptop with that. But actually, one of the interesting things is new technology that's coming out called thin film solar, which is This is silicon-based solar panels, and thin-film solars are largely made without silicon, so that the cost... Silicon is in high demand and low supply right now, so it's very expensive, and this is solar-grade silicon. And so thin-film solar takes out the silicon, makes it out of these different materials, and then has an inkjet printing process or a spray-on process that different companies are innovating on these processes. And so that's it's a very hot industry right now, and a lot of these companies are getting hundreds of millions of dollars to create this technology. Some of the ones in Silicon Valley are called NanoSolar. They started producing their material in December. Another one is actually an Austin-based company called Heliovolt, which is a well-known company in this area. So...
this one's really, it strikes me as a very South by Southwest topic. This is about essentially how do you create the environment around you in data? It's almost sort of like recreating like the Matrix, right? Or actually like creating it for the first time. You're essentially trying to pull all of this atmospheric data into something that you can see. It's like, how are you making the invisible environmental factors around you visible? So one of the most high-profile efforts in this area is MIT has actually launched a pervasive sensing program in Singapore. We're essentially going to have, you know, they're going to be tracking like 60 data points over the entire city. Basically, you're tracking the urban ecology of the city. Like, how are the people interacting with the city? When people get up and start driving cars, what does that do to the biosphere? What does that do to all these things? And it's going to essentially create this kind of, you know, SimCity-like interface where someone's going to be, like, sitting in a control room in Singapore, and it's a little freaky, but they're going to be sitting in a control room in Singapore with, like, real-time access to, like, all of the sorts of, like, emissions, pollutants, pollen counts, temperatures, water vapor over the entire city of Singapore. If that sounds a little, like, authoritarian, I mean, if there is a way to, like, crowdsource these things, and again... not to rep Nokia too hard, but Nokia's coming out, they have a concept called the EcoSensor, and essentially is a phone that everyone can carry around that could generate a lot of those same types of data as this MIT environmental sensing program, and would, you know, let people know, all right, these are the pollutants that are on, you know, 3rd and Bryan in San Francisco right now. And then those things could all be networked, and you could basically generate this kind of another kind of mixed reality. Of pollutants and people, like, really within the built and natural environment. I think Katie has a little bit of Google Earth and Google Maps, Gen 1 of this stuff.
well, we at Earth Detect have been using Google Maps to plot different, I guess you'd call them industry features. The financial community and environmentalists have started to make a lot of progress by stopping the building of coal plants in the U.S. So we started this coal plant death watch map that we put together on Google Maps. And I think there's something like 50 or something on there now. And we did the same thing with the ethanol industry is having some problems right now because they're not making that much money. Their margins are very small. So we also created a like ethanol plant death watch map. And we also have a 101 clean tech startups map that we've been putting together. You might not be that interested in that unless you want to invest in one of these companies or know where they're located. But we're going to be building that into about 500 clean tech companies that we're going to be building over the next couple months. Anyway, so those are some ways to use maps. Some of the more interesting ones, companies have turned to Google Earth to do overlay satellite imagery. The EPA has created an air emissions overlay to show air quality in terms of geography, as Alexis was talking about that a little bit. There's other researchers at Woods Hole Research Center. They created this national biomass and carbon data set, which was funded by NASA and the Geological Survey. And that basically it shows the best plant-based carbon sinks in the U.S., if you care about stuff like that. There's also a University of Kansas professors with the National Energy Technology Labs made a look at where all the carbon emissions in the U.S. are being generated via electricity generation, cement plants, stuff like that. So there's a lot of ways to use Google Earth and Google Maps to plot what is happening with carbon emissions and to also organize data that can be used to fight climate change.
Quick review.
Sorry.
I think maybe I'll also add about Google Maps is that Google itself is doing a lot to promote the use of their technology to have greener good. Google's eco director, Dan Riker, has been talking about this a lot and actively seeking green ideas and green organization tools to use with Google Earth and Google Maps. Oh, is that me again? I'm just going to go through here so
Yeah. That kind of happened unintentionally that Katie and I talked about that stuff together, so I think now you're going to hear a lot from Sarah.
All right. This is just kind of an overview slide. I sort of divided up some of the ideas that I'm going to talk about into four sort of degrees of scale out from the individual. So there are some of these gadgets out there right now, and a lot of the stuff that we talk about, talked about on World Changing and in Habitat and kind of in general are often concepts that don't exist yet. I think that's still sort of apt to discuss because a lot of them are coming out and a lot of people who are involved in technology here have a lot of power to sort of drive demand for these concepts to come into reality. I'll just dive in. So some of these concepts look at monitoring energy use at home or in your office. One of the concepts, I pulled this picture up that's a satellite image of the Earth at night because it sort of reminds me of the way this concept I'm going to talk about looks, which is this. This is a French designer named Gilles Belli who has done a bunch of different sort of energy saving concepts, and this is one of my favorites. It attaches to your desktop, as you can see, and then each of these little segments has an adapter, so you can plug all your different devices into it, and there's a light display that shows when how much energy each of these devices is pulling, and then when it's fully charged, and you're meant to turn it off when it's fully charged, but if you are too lazy or whatever, negligent to turn it off, it'll just switch it off for you. So it's kind of it suggests interacting and paying attention, but it also kind of saves you if you don't. He actually developed this with the French National Electricity Company, so that's something that seems to have a lot of potential to come into existence. Another one that actually does exist now, when we first started talking about it, it didn't yet, is the Watson by this company called DIY Kyoto. I like the company name because obviously it's sort of a suggestion of if your country hasn't approved the Kyoto Protocol, you can take it into your own hands. And this one has this kind of cool, it's a really nice design, I think, so it's something you would want to have like out on a tabletop at home, which I think is an important part of designing green concepts or green products. This is a little digital display of energy use in your home, and you can have it display either wattage or units of currency, how much you're using, and then it glows according to how much you're using, so it's kind of all these different indicators. And then the actual material that it's made of can be recycled at the end or reused in another product. Then sort of moving out from that awareness raising stuff is some of what these guys already talked about, but products that generate energy in some way other than electric and sometimes other than even, you know, renewable alternatives. But there's kinetic energy, like we already discussed. There are a bunch of different ideas in institutional environments where using the energy generated by people's footprints in high traffic areas can actually create, you know, the lighting in a train station or something like that, which is kind of cool. Some of you may have seen this one. It's a company called Patenco, and probably what you've seen is the one laptop per child, which is one of the main products they're generating this for. It's a little pull cord, like a yo-yo pull cord generator, and each time you pull on it, it generates a little bit. There are some stats up there about sort of how much energy you're going to get out of it for how much pulling, but this is something they're able to use and implement in a lot of developing areas where there isn't access to other sources of power, and this is really easy. It's really durable, so that's kind of cool. This is when another concept that came from the Greener Gadgets and Habitat event, and it's a wind-up cell phone. So the material, again, itself is it's made from bamboo, so that's a renewable material. And then the way that this charges is by winding, sort of like those little crank toys you used to have when you were a kid. And so this, again, is in concept, but it's something where, I don't know, when I first saw it, I mean, sometimes these concepts strike me as a little bit unrealistic, like how many times you're going to sit around winding your cell phone, I'm not really sure. I'm sort of skeptical. On the other hand, it's sort of a nice gesture, symbol towards the idea that there are different types of natural human movement that you can incorporate into a product and take advantage of to generate electricity.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I think that's there's among the kind of DIY energy sources, there's kind of two types. There's the kind of ambient energy harvesters, where just like you go around your day and your shirt moves and it generates electricity to power, I don't know, your shirt, I guess, or something. And then there's these ones that Sarah's talking about, where it's actually you're like, you know, being mindful about generating the power. And it's like the big difference seems to me, it's like when you're doing something intentional, like the actual Petenko pull cord generator now, it actually works like this. Like you're actually like you have two things and you're pulling, and the reason they said that, the reason they did it that way, is because it like engages like all of these muscles. So it's like you got this and this, and it's like all working, right? And the problem with the ambient energy generators is that a lot of the time they don't, like the ones I was talking about as opposed to the ones Sarah was talking about, they just don't generate that much power yet. Someone said in the Mevo chat room they think it's going to get big. I hope so, but it's like it's kind of hard to tell, I think.
And then this is another one that there are now a bunch of different products out. When we first started talking about this on Inhabitat, it was more conceptual, but this is not an unrealistic idea, and I really love this one. It's a method, it has a bunch of different names. Often we call it sunlight transport on Inhabitat. I've seen hybrid solar recently, but basically using solar collectors on a rooftop and through fiber optic cables pulling sunlight indoors and using a light fixture to distribute that light. But what comes out is not only solar, it's also really nice light quality. So I think the sort of added bonus, and you know, I spent 2 years living in Seattle recently and it's dark all the time, and full spectrum light bulbs and all these kinds of things are meant to sort of boost your mood. But I think, you know, you can see photos on some of these websites of windowless rooms where they've brought, through fiber optics, brought solar in, and it's the light quality is pretty amazing. So it would make a really, you know, miserable, small windowless office a more pleasant, healthy place to work. And then sort of the next scale out, and this comes away a little bit from what the individual can do necessarily, but prefab and rapid manufacturing are both new, like industrial technologies that are working to reduce waste and make a lot of manufacturing processes a lot greener. So prefab is a big topic on Inhabitat. There's a link at the bottom here, but you can find more examples. This is just one example of, and I like this one because it sort of shows some of the other extra things you can do. So this is made of prefabricated panels. It also has a flat top where you can put a green roof and, you know, big windows so you can let in a lot of daylight. So there are a lot of other sort of sustainable features that can be built into something that's made on a factory line, and the impact to the site is less, and the transport often, if it's manufactured close by, is decreased. And then at a slightly smaller scale, this is from an article I just edited for Dwell, is... or Katie was just talking about sort of spray-on solar printing. Any sort of 3D manufacturing, 3D printing, is getting to be something that's a little bit more commonly used. This is a bench made by a Dutch company, I believe, called Freedom of Creation. And this was entirely generated with 3D printing, and it's actually really large. You can't tell from the picture. But it's basically like a rapid layering of really, really fine material until it's built up into this object. And you can do this with a lot of different items. This is one example of a piece of furniture. And then finally, the sort of big idea is service systems. And you know, after talking a lot about products, ultimately the greenest thing is the whole idea of not buying anything or reducing the amount of material and stuff that you're using in order to get the same results and the same kind of lifestyle that you want. And this is happening a lot with service systems. This little diagram comes from a student project at the RSA in London, which was sort of a set of different service systems that were meant to be incorporated into a neighborhood or a city where any one of these is sort of, just to give you an idea of what a service system is, it was, it's meant to sort of say, okay, if the outcome you want is, well, you know, ride sharing is one example of this, but these guys did a couple of other ones. I'm trying to think of what one of them was. In any case, if the outcome you want is something you can get without buying something or using, you know, owning a product, then how can you make that happen? And it's often through networking individuals to share a particular item. So there's tool sharing. And now one of the ones that I thought was sort of relevant for us today is the idea of co-working spaces. A lot of people at this conference, a lot of people in general, are starting to work independently more frequently. And so, you know, working from home and not commuting is obviously a sort of a green way to work, but a lot of people want the community of an office space. And there are a lot of co-working spaces now popping up that are trying to incorporate green, general green office principles. So, you know, CFLs in the light fixtures and, you know, different types of sustainable office supplies and equipment. And then you rent your space. So your space ends up being only yours when you need it and someone else's when they need it. And it's highly efficient. There's a new one that just launched called Launchpad in Austin this week. I haven't seen it, but I've been hearing about it. And there are a bunch of wikis and community boards where you can learn about co-working spaces in your city. But a lot of them are really cool. This picture is from one called Workspace in Vancouver, where I've been. And it's a really beautiful space. And, you know, you sort of have the opportunity, again, with e-waste and that kind of thing. You know, once you develop a community of other people who are highly dependent on electronics, this is a really good way to end up not throwing out your gadgets. But maybe there's somebody also, you know, using Workspace there that wants to use something that you're done with. So it kind of increases the likelihood of reuse and efficiency in general. I think that's it for me.
Do you want to take questions?
I was going to ask you, do you want to switch with me and go through some of
these? No, I've gone through those. Right? No, just get the
answer. You don't want to show Facebook or do the carbon? Because I've got them pulled up.
I mean, we only have 10 minutes, 15
yeah.
minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're open for Q&A. So please come up to the mic and ask away.
I did see one. I did see one question from the Miwa room. Was does anyone know who makes a product that replaces your power outlets with networked outlets that can be managed from a central computer? Someone suggested X10, and I don't know if Katie wanted to mention GreenPlug. I don't know if it works like that.
Well, GreenPlug is a smart power adapter, universal power adapter that saves power by sending like precisely the required amount of power to each connected device, and that eliminates the problem of phantom power. So that's one that a lot of people have been talking about recently. I haven't actually tested it, but.
Yeah. You guys talk about dematerialization and not adopting these gadgets that save power if you can share them with other people, but in terms of if you already have something in your home and you don't want to, you know, throw it out to get something that you think is greener, I mean, how do you approach that? Do you just use it into the ground or, like,
I know of a few websites. I think they're like buymytronics.com, or there's a couple of them. Maybe you guys can help me out, where you can actually send in your broken iPod or your broken whatever, and the people and will fix it and send it back to you. They're like very small kind of Web 2.0 startup companies that have launched to start services like these.
I'd also say that, I mean, I guess I approach it from a slightly different angle, that there's just, you know, because I used to write about consumers, there's like consumer pyramid, right? And some people are going to be pretty ideologically pure and are going to like keep every gadget till it runs into the ground. It's absolutely dead. Other people are going to approach it in a variety of different ways, including, you know, throwing out the old gadget to get a or recycling the old gadget to get a new one, right? So, I mean, I think we're kind of assuming that you know, anytime you can, you should be recycling your e-waste and not just throwing it out.
Thanks.
Katie, you spoke on tracking ethanol providers.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a particular issue. I've been reading seemingly more critical perspectives on ethanol in that one issue that is it's made such a boom for corn that it's driving up food prices. Mm-hmm. You know, people in Central and South America aren't able to afford tortillas and this kind of thing. Also, the environmental impacts of farming heavily an intensive crop like that in America is really doing more damage through the Mississippi and the dead zone that comes, you know, from all the farmland. It seems, I guess, what's your take? Where do you fall on this? Is it, do we just embrace these things kind of out of knee-jerk? I mean, because it's been about a year and a half, and it's already seeming like there might be some serious
yeah.
sustainability issues.
So I think it's pretty clear that corn-based ethanol is a bad idea. Most people think that the companies aren't doing that well right now as far as revenues go, and the sustainability issues of corn-based ethanol are really obvious to everybody. So I think everyone's in agreement that we need some kind of other alternative to ethanol and biofuels, there's a lot of companies trying to look into how to create sustainable and effective and energy efficient biofuels. So there's a lot of companies in Silicon Valley right now doing that. Some of them use genomics to tweak. Alexis can talk about this as well. But Craig Venter is a really famous genomics scientist, and he has a company called Synthetic Genomics. So they're working on ways to create organisms that are highly efficient that will generate one process, so they'll convert sugar into ethanol in an extremely efficient way. Obviously, there's lots of controversies with that avenue as well. There's another company called Coscata, who GM actually just invested in, and they're trying to use waste. This is cellulosic ethanol, is one of the next generations of ethanol, using waste and non-food-based biomass to create ethanol. So there's a variety of ways. I think it's pretty clear from the research and science that corn-based ethanol is not a good idea, and now we're trying to figure out if biofuels are the way to go in general, and if so, then what's the proper method?
I mean, I think the other thing to say about ethanol is it's like not about the climate, right? I mean, I think ethanol is about what's called energy security or energy independence. It's about people who don't want to be importing oil. And they want to be giving subsidies to the middle of the country. I mean, that's kind of what, at least for corn-based ethanol, like that's really what it's about. And I think, you know, the other problem with biofuels, I think, even when you're talking about waste streams, is like, where do you go get a big waste stream, right? I mean, there's not like a company out there necessarily that's just going to like sell you like, you know, millions of tons of whatever so that you can make, you know, millions of gallons of biofuel. And I think that, I mean, the options for fuel-based mobility, I think, are going to start looking pretty slim. And I think, but that's okay. I mean, I think the main advantage of liquid fuels, it's easy to transport. And I think as the grid gets better and as all these other things get better, like batteries, then all of a sudden transporting energy for your car isn't going to be quite as hard.
I was just going to add, too, that and the other one that I was going to mention as a biofuel solution that's non-food-based is there's a lot of work into algae that's happening, and that's a really interesting one. But I think in general, this conversation about fuel is kind of it's just kind of an interesting look at like what half steps towards solutions look like and how much you have to continue to look towards full solutions of what that means. And, you know, basically you couldn't say, okay, now we've made ethanol, we solved the problem, or, you know, now we made biodiesel, we solved the problem. You know, I drive a biodiesel car and have for about 4 years, and initially it was like, just having biodiesel was really great. Then it went to, okay, now it's not anymore because, you know, we're monocropping and creating all these agricultural issues, so you have to have biodiesel that's made of grease that came from restaurants that are local, but it speaks to, like, you know, locally appropriate solutions networked so that you create a more you know, widespread solution. Just wanted to add that.
So I actually work in nonprofit sector, and even in that, it's entirely impractical to turn off computers at night. The previous association I worked for, we had offices all over the globe. I mean, it's a global world, and we have shared servers, and you have backups that need to run. The office I'm in now, it's AIGA, the Professional Association for Design, and we have a really major initiative for sustainable design, Center for Sustainable Design. We can't turn our computers off at night because we need to run our backups. So that's one of those frustrating, most essential things I hear over and over again. I don't see how business can actually do that. I personally can do that at home.
Do you want to go? Go ahead. I know there's one idea that there's a company called Verdium, V-E-R-D-I-E-U-M, I think it's called, or just E-M. I-E-M, and they're in Silicon Valley, and they create a software and a service for companies to have an efficient way to manage the energy of your network PCs at your company, so the IT manager can, you know, plug in all these data points to all the connected computers, and the software can manage when the computers go into sleep mode, you know, which computers are drawing too much energy. So there are solutions like that that companies, small startup companies and bigger companies are trying to create to solve, to answer problems like that.
I was just going to add that I think computers are just going to be way better at that than human beings, like being able to figure out which parts can be switched off and which can't. And that's why, yeah, it's great that these companies are coming around.
And I'd also like to add that I'd like to put you in touch with our clean and green IT department, because we work almost exclusively with nonprofits. So if you're still here, you can talk to me about that afterwards. Okay.
So I write an environmental blog, and one of the things that I'm always looking for is new environmental products to feature and things that I can tell people about. One of the things that I find really frustrating is that in the mainstream media, environmentally friendliness and green, it's very much a sweetheart issue right now. But in a lot of ways, most corporations, most publications and whatnot aren't taking it as a really serious thing. Like, you'll look at a magazine and it'll have a little sort of very thin, green products, that's great. But in the real, you know, it's kind of greenwashing, but it's also, you know, in the real life, not a whole lot of people are really taking a green initiative. You know, you look at, a conference like this, for example, there's disposable cups made from, you know, non-sustainably everywhere. Yeah, me and my Starbucks cup over there. So I'm just wondering, in your opinion, what you think it'll take to really make everyone pay attention. It's like, okay, when for cup manufacturers, make sure that your cups are made from recycled materials. Or for conferences, look at ways to make things like this more sustainable. So I hope that made sense.
I think it mostly at a corporate level is people are changing when they recognize that it's going to bring them more money to do so. And there are a lot of examples of corporations that have, you know, probably like the best one from deep inside the green world is Interface Carpets, which had this, you know, the CEO of Interface had this like incredible revelation about what could happen if he took his incredibly petroleum intensive business and made a bunch of changes that would make his product more sustainable. And they saved, I have no idea how much, but like so much money. You hear the CEO's name is Ray Anderson, and you hear him tell the story, and it's like, you know, he was clearly moved by the idea that he could do something good and make more money. And I think that a lot of other companies have had that same thing happen. And I think at that level, it's like, I kind of think it's all about money.
Yeah, I totally agree. Walmart is the chief example of this. They're doing a dramatic push to bring down their carbon footprint, and that is only to make money. I mean, I'm sure they appreciate the green PR from it, but they're going to be cutting a lot of their carbon emissions in their supply chain and using a lot of software to do that, and it's chiefly to save money.
Also, Kurt P says the consumer can change the corporate behavior. Don't wait for them to change for you. That's from the Meebo room.
The interface example you mentioned is great, and that story and a whole bunch of others are in a book I really like called Natural Capitalism, which is all about how you can be more green and make tons more money doing it. And the reason I came up here, I want to answer two questions. Someone asked about having a device that could turn power off to other devices remotely. We use one of these at work for battery life testing. APC makes it. It's a 1U unit. You plug it into your network. You can connect all the other devices, and you can remotely turn things on and off, which mm-hmm. is pretty handy. It's not super practical for your house. Like, you don't want to put it in your living room. But if it's you're in an office environment, it's super great. For the woman who said she couldn't shut off her computers because she could do backups, well, you can put your computers to sleep. And I know this is built into every Mac, and it's probably built into Windows, too. There's an option called Wake on Ethernet Network Administrator Access. So the server can just wake it up at 3 a.m., do the backup, and it can go back to sleep. And sleep is not shut down, but it's still like a huge number of fewer watts that's being used. And that's free. And if you want more control, like you want to wake it up at 3 and turn it off at 4 and wake it up at, you know, there's free third-party software to do that. And someone tells South by Southwest that those stupid green cards you fill out when you register are a big waste of paper.
Thanks.
We only have 1 minute left, but maybe one question.
Well, I'll ask the greenwashing question since you put the slide up. Two parts of it. Well, so, you know, there's so many industries like energy industry or the automotive industry that 90% plus of the advertising is about green stuff, and 90% plus of the products have nothing to do with those claims. So I guess I have a two-part question. One is, what is the responsibility of the people in this room as consumers to vet these things and really double-check the, quote, green products that they're buying? And then on the other hand, what is the responsibility of the people in this room as facilitators of advertising? Because I know, like, a lot of people run ads on their sites to vet the products that they're promoting through. When a lot of the times it's sort of contextual, you know, not to call out any specific names there, but sort of the two-pronged as consumers and also as promoters of advertising.
I think that this is a conversation that could go on for a long time, and we're out of time.
Yeah, we've got to make it short, but I think you want to give a short answer, and then...
Yeah, I mean, I was mostly going to say, I think it is important for there to be a vetting process, and it's really hard to know when you're getting a reliable answer about something, and that's why I personally think that, you know, changing things at the design phase is really important so that you don't as much have to know as much at the consumer end, but I think, yeah, with the amount of stuff out there right now that's being marketed as green and not being green, there's, you know, it's pretty important to try to dig in a little bit, especially if you are running ads, and find out what it is you're advertising before you just see, like, something that is painted green and you know, and run it. That's a pretty lame answer.
It's probably also our job, too, as news media covering green. Yeah. So,
sure, we do our task.
I mean, and I guess the last thing I was to add, I just feel like there's a little bit of a danger because people are so fatigued on the term green and all these sort of things and greenwashing that we become like such hawks about like fighting every like greenwashing effort that we like forget like any effort that looks good all of a sudden looks bad, you know? I mean, not every effort to like go green is necessarily a bad thing.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.